from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. More than once during his rise, Hall of Fame quarterback Steve Young nearly walked away from football, like when he was an eighth-string quarterback at BYU with a coach who said he'd never make it because he was a lefty, or after he signed the largest contract in sports history and felt overwhelmed by impossible expectations. The two-time NFL MVP and Super Bowl MVP writes about these struggles, as well as his legendary triumphs, in his new memoir, QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. It's a life 49ers fans might be surprised to learn was beset by anxiety, at times so intense it threatened to sideline him. Steve Young finally did walk away from football when a concussion ended his career at the age of 37. Steve Young, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And congratulations on the book.
Yeah. Everyone says that. Congratulations. And it seems like, is it congratulations because you finished it I'm a first time author. So I was like, oh, thank you. Congratulations. I don't know. It's a funny thing there, but everyone says the same thing.
Well, I think it's quite an accomplishment, right? And particularly a book that you've written where you really looked at some pretty hard moments in your life. And one of the things I also read was that you initially wanted to write this for your kids.
So, yeah, I think it's probably good to go from the beginning. So I finished playing in 2000. And my first son was born in 2000. So he had no – as he grew up – we live in the Bay Area, so he would go to school, and his dad obviously was someone that was well known, and he had to get used to hearing people say things like, "Oh, your dad did this," or "Your dad did that," and he'd come home and say, "Dad, is that true?" And I'd think, a lot of the times I'd be like, "No, it's not true," and so I started thinking, "Oh my gosh, my children," and we had four children, as they were going through school and really in throughout their lives, they're going to hear about their dad. They have no affiliation, weren't around. With that time. And I just got thinking, I need to write my story for them. And that's where this started. This did not start as a book. This didn't start as a project for anything other than to hand a narrative of some kind that I could give to the kids. And so when I, a close friend I was talking to one day about this dilemma that I was in, and he said, "I have a guy that I think could help you, Jeff Benedict." And I'd never heard of Jeff. And he's a writer, and he's somebody that maybe could help you kind of collect your stories, collect what you have to say, collect things. And so I called him and engaged that with him to go and talk to my family, talk to my friends, talk to teammates, coaches, and just see if you can't put a narrative together for my children. And literally and I didn't even know what it would look like. I didn't know if it would be a box. I didn't know if it would be just a collection of – I didn't know how it would look. Yeah. But Jeff decided that he was going to write it in chapters. And I thought, this is scary. And that's the beginning. That's how it started.
And a big theme that runs through this is your struggle with anxiety and eventually how you overcame it. Those moments I mentioned at the top of the introduction about BYU after you signed your first contract also with USFL, those two moments, how much did anxiety play a role in your decisions? Or you didn't make a final decision, but you were very close to making a final decision to walk away.
Yeah.
How much role did anxiety play?
So it's hard to know how fundamental things in your life inform everything that you do, but it's there. And so I think what I wrote was my experience not knowing that I had a pretty severe case of child separation anxiety, as I found out. And now I found out that it kind of runs in my mom's family. It's the kind of thing that is sprinkled around. And for me, it showed up early in my life when no one really knew. And even my family, I would, like in first grade, I wouldn't go to school. And so my parents were like, "Well, you got to go to school." And I didn't know how to express that I was scared to go to school. And really what I was saying is, I don't want to leave home. And that's common for kids that have separation anxiety.
Yeah, you wrote that your mom ended up having to stay at school whole day.
She would walk me to school and stay until I got more used to it. And what happened, it was much later in my life that I realized what I was trying to replicate was home. And when I felt at home, things were okay. But when I felt away from home, it was very full of anxious moments. And so after a few weeks, she stopped having to come because I obviously felt like first grade was now a place that I could be home. And then second grade, I remember very vividly being picked up by my dad after school. and driving to my aunt's house where we were going to stay for the weekend while my parents went away. The idea of my parents going away was just overwhelming, and I didn't know how to express it. And so they did go away, and I had one of the worst, most traumatic weekends of my life, you know, with the fear and anxiety that was around that weekend. And so as I look back through my life and say those fundamental memories should have been more informative, but you get over. My parents come back, I'm like, oh, okay, that's over. And during the days, I was, you know, great. I was playing sports. I was doing well in school. But at night, I'm home. Yes. And so that idea of home plays out as you watch me try to make the transition to college, which was death-defying to me, and then finding home there, and then now trying to go pro and have a new home, right. And that transition. So the transitions particularly were – and I even think, you know, the transitions that you know, takes time. But then why would I choose a profession that would put me in front of 80,000 people every week? And then not only that, take on the pressures of Jim McMahon in college, one of the great college quarterbacks that ever played.
BYU, yeah.
And Joe Montana. Like, how did I find my way to get into these situations that were, you know, people around me saying, boy, you seem to have a lot of anxiety about it, but I would even have more. And I'd be thinking, I've found ways to actually expand on this theme to make it more, you know, crazier than it even could be. And that's part of the story.
Right. Yeah. Your coping mechanisms were, or you're enforced to cope, really, in some ways. As you mentioned, when you were at BYU, you were able to, rather than stay in the dorm, you stayed at somebody's home.
Right. I was
like
always
home,
looking for a home.
Kids.
You know, and my parents did know that. My dad, you know, throughout my life, my dad would always, whenever I would struggle, he'd like, Steve, I mean, you've got a great life. Especially when I was playing pro football, he loved football. He loves football even more than me. He's like, this is my dream. You're playing football. You're getting paid to play a game. Go have fun. And I'm like, fun? Like, we just never connected because in that way, genetic anxiety, I don't think it makes sense to people that don't have it. It just makes – it's disconnected.
There was a story you wrote about that particularly struck me, which was, you know, you had – walked onto the team at BYU. You wanted to be a quarterback. The coach at that time said you'll never be a quarterback, right, because right. You're a lefty and you can't throw, which is kind of amazing now about what we know about you now. But you packed your bag and you called your dad and you said, I'm quitting and I'm coming home. And your dad said, you can quit, but you can't come home because we won't have a quitter in our house.
It was – and he was serious. His nickname is Grit and he means it. Like it's like – he has gold teeth and he kind of, you know, like he's a teddy bear, but he's very serious about certain things. And quitting was one of them, you know. And the truth is, when I went to school across the country from Connecticut, I didn't unpack my bags ever for the first semester. They stayed packed. And early on in that first summer camp for the football, I was an eighth string quarterback. I didn't know that when I took the scholarship, and BYU at that time was a school that was one of the few schools that threw the football. Most colleges were running the football. And so it was highly sought after for quarterbacks who wanted to go pro because that Stanford and Miami were the three places where you could kind of be tutored in the pro game. And so I found myself in the middle of all these guys from all the country. And so I found myself eighth string. And so eighth string really means that I was the quarterback that prepared our defense for that week's game. So I was the quarterback for the opposing team during the week. And I always joke that defensive players, not the smartest guys in the world, didn't actually realize that I wasn't the quarterback for the team. You know, they really beat on me pretty good. And I think that was the one I called my dad. Because deep down, I wanted to go home. Regardless of how bad it was going in football, I wanted comfort. When you feel anxious, you want relief. And relief was home. And so I always constantly was being pushed away from that, and that's why I always say go through it, because you're being pushed to do things that are not comfortable, and you always want comfort. And so that's when I called him. I felt like I had a good enough story for him to buy. Like, this is how bad it is, Dad. This is how bad it's going, and even you would see that this is that I need to come home. And when he said that to me, I thought to myself, well, I really have nowhere else to go. And so
you stuck
I guess
it out.
I think I'm going to stick it out. And I think it's informative as I parent, and really for anybody. There, you know, that doesn't mean that every time as a parent you'd say, I don't care how hard, it's not a lesson, but it's just informative for that moment. I would have come home. If he said, you're right, Steve, this is not working out. You come home and we'll deal with this later. I would have taken my bag, which was already packed, and headed home. And that would have changed my life, probably not for the best.
We're talking with NFL Hall of Famer and former 49ers quarterback Steve Young. His autobiography with Jeff Benedict is called QB, My Life Behind the Spiral, and it details his struggle with anxiety. And Steve Young, could I ask you to read a passage from your book?
Sure.
And this is a passage that you wrote after you were with the 49ers for some years. And I want you to read this particular one because I think it really gives a sense of how intense and paralyzing the anxiety was for you, even as an adult who, you know, you'd already been MVP at this point. And just to set it up, the passage I'm asking you to read is the first home game since Joe Montana was traded to Kansas City. It's September 1993. You haven't slept for 40 hours. You've been vomiting. And there are signs everywhere of love for Joe Montana and no signs of love for you among the fans at Candlestick. And this is the game against the Atlanta Falcons.
Yeah, that's good. That's good context. And so I'll start. We hang on to win 37-30, but on our final play, I'm struck on the side of the head and I feel something pop in my neck. I walk off the field gingerly. Despite being sleep deprived, famished, and hampered by a jammed neck from the blow to the head, I have one of the best games of my career, completing 18 of 22 passes for 210 yards and 3 touchdowns. I also rush for 52 yards and catch one of my own passes. I staggered to the training room. This is a little more dramatic. Okay, so I staggered to the training room where I undergo a neurological exam. Sorry about that. Dr. Clint tells me that I have jammed neck and a mild concussion. After some electrostimulation, he gives me an anti-inflammatory and puts a cervical soft collar on my neck. But my neck is the least of my problems. My emotions are on the surface, and I don't want anyone to see me this way. I lie on my back on the training table until everyone except Dr. Clint is gone. Then I sit up. Reggie, can I talk to you? He looks at me. Dry sweat and grass stains coat my skin. My hair is matted from my helmet. You look like you haven't slept in days, he says. I haven't. He closes the training room door. Steve, what's going on? I bury my face in my hands and start to shake. It's okay, Steve, he whispers. Reggie, I'm really struggling. Yeah, I know. I start sobbing. What's wrong with me, Reggie? He puts his arms around me. I'm sure this doesn't make any sense to you, I continue. Steve? What? I understand, he whispers. I had bouts of this all through my days in medical school. I look up. Reggie is crying. I know all about anxiety, he says. I understand how it works. Is that what this is, I ask? I hug him and wipe my eyes.
It's Steve Young reading from QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. How much of a relief was it to know that you had a thing?
It was the difference. There was nothing more valuable, even following for years. There was nothing more valuable than understanding that, first of all, it's genetic, that it's in my mom's family, that this is somewhat common, that just putting a name to understanding what the feelings were. It meant the world to me. It was a tremendous relief. It was still hard. I mean, it doesn't go away. I think over the years of playing, it waned to a point where I just, it doesn't really affect my life at all anymore.
Sure. But even doctor, once you started to actually see a doctor for anxiety specifically,
right.
The doctor said, I have never seen an adult with this kind of separation anxiety. He was just saying that you had a particularly...
Well, he had 10 questions. And if you said yes to 5 of them, he diagnosed you with this separation anxiety, this genetic separation anxiety. Childhood. That's undiagnosed in adults a lot of times. And he said, and so I said yes to 9. And the 10th one was a question I couldn't answer because he said, you have nightmares about... And I just... I don't remember my dreams very well, so I've never been great at that. And so he said, Steve, I got to be honest with you. People that I run into that have this, what I would say a more severe case of childhood separation anxiety that are diagnosed as adults, Usually they're not MVPs of the NFL. And I don't really know what to do with you. And I said, well, I don't know that I really need you to do much with me. You've already done it in a way. It's just so powerful. Because all the years that I've played, I felt like it was outsized. I'd see others that were nervous or felt, you know, everyone gets butterflies. And so I, you know, but I always, my good friend, John Taylor, who I played for years, he could laugh in pregame. He could laugh on the bus. He could laugh on the plane. He could laugh in the huddle. He could laugh as he scored a touchdown. Everything was funny and enjoyable to him. And he was my dream. It was a dream to be John Taylor and just laugh your way through it all, and how much I was not laughing through it.
And you didn't, once it was diagnosed, take medication for it.
Well, I tried briefly, and it just made me feel like a blanket was over my head. It didn't help, you know. And so for me, the knowledge was the key. And I'm not saying I think it's important that it can help and be a lifesaver for many people. So I don't, as I realize, especially after this book, that there's so many that have come to me and said, Steve, my son, my daughter, me, I've struggled with these kinds of things. And I want people to know that I don't, my way is not the way that I suggest for anybody. But for me, the knowledge was the key. And the medicine really just made me feel like it didn't help.
Well, what also probably didn't help was the fact that you were brought into the 49ers to basically follow Joe Montana. And you thought when you came in that you would be a starting quarterback because Joe Montana was hurt. So here you are coming in to essentially then become the backup, right, for one of the greatest quarterbacks, if not the greatest of all time.
Of course.
So people would say, was there any part of you that resented head coach Bill Walsh after he kind of lured you to San Francisco?
Sure, of course. I mean, it was really hard because I'd come from a really lousy team.
And you need
a lot of help in the NFL to be good. Anyone who says, I'm great and I don't need any help is lying. You need a lot of help in football. And that's why it makes football so unique and different. So that's why I say it's the great team game, because you need so much help. And so joining the 49ers, the opportunity when Bill worked me out when they were trying to work out the trade, and his pitch was, because the pitch, if the original pitch was, Steve, Joe's one of the great players of all time, we'd like you to come learn from him, and then at some point in the future maybe you play, I honestly would have maybe petulantly, not realizing that was a great opportunity, would have said no, because I knew that I didn't want to watch. I'd rather go to law school, to be honest with you, than watch. And so that wouldn't have worked. But he didn't try that. He said to me, Steve, Joe's had his second back surgery, and there's no way that he can continue. And not that I was – I had no – I was sad, I didn't – I was sorry to hear about
poorly,
that.
Yes.
Right. But we'd love you to come and kind of take his place. And I thought that was a great honor to think that I could do that. And so I made the decision to come to San Francisco feeling this honor to come and actually get in the huddle with this great team and try to, you know, step into the shoes of Joe Montana, which I knew would be big. Little did I know, the first practice, the team that came out, which is this famous team of, you know, at that point it was Ronnie Lott and Jerry Rice and Roger Craig and Tom Rathman, and, you know, you go on and on, Randy Cross and, I mean, Michael Carr. I mean, just, it was the Super Bowl teams of the 80s. And Joe was the last one to come out. And I remember seeing him for the first time, and immediately what I thought to myself, oh, my gosh, he's not hurt. And I'm like, it's too late now. And I remember telling Bill many times, Bill, why didn't you tell me that he was like fine? And not only fine, he went on to win multiple MVPs,
right? I mean,
multiple
amazing,
Super Bowls. In the middle of it, I'm trying to dig through my career and say to myself, I refuse to have it go down where I don't play. And so luckily I played enough and played successfully so that it became, you know, I found some solace in getting on the field enough. But Joe and I did recently a commercial together, which it was never toxic between the two of us. It was never, we never had a crossword. We never argued. We had thousands of hours together in meeting rooms and buses and planes and trains and everywhere. We supported each other the best we could. And I've said many, many times, it went as well as it could have gone. But it was always awkward. And we did a commercial recently titled Awkward. And it was a really, I think, an embodiment of our time together. It was always awkward because there was one job and two guys.
One of my colleagues in the newsroom, Alex Helmick, had this question that he wanted me to ask you, which I thought was so great. What's one of the worst things you heard from fans when you became the starter over Montana that you can say on the radio?
Well, it was – first of all, you have to – if you're going to survive something like that, you have to take it in context. You can't – if everything's going to eat at you – and I tried to insulate myself from a lot of it because it was impossible. I'd be on the bread line at the grocery store and the woman behind me would be talking to the person next to her and she'd be like, Steve Young's trying to play for Joe Montana. He's horrible. I'm like, I'm in the bread line. Can I just get some groceries? You turn on the radio, you know. And so I think the things that hurt the most were the things that were unfair, like that anyone that said Joe's the greatest was like, of course he is, you know, and Steve's horrible. Yeah, it's an opinion. It's fine. But there were some things that felt like personal, you know, like there's something that went to my talent and thing. Like I would take them personally. Like I'm a good player. Like when my mom would yell into the stands, you know, to people when they'd boo me, you know, like he's a good player. You know, I think those are the ones that hurt the most when the people think I could do the job. And they, you know, the banners and there was, I mean, you go back, remember there was the famous, for me, famous, probably no one else remembers, but headline in the Chronicle, right after the Gulf War broke out, it says, what's the Gulf War? It's Steve Young's fault. Meaning like, everything must, you know, it's, yeah. Everything's
so really
his fault.
Kind of,
yeah. Maybe that's the one that hurt the most. Your question from your producer is like the headline in the Chronicle, the Gulf War.
No, they probably were also saying that maybe you were getting, you were getting more than you deserve. We're talking with NFL Hall of Famer and former 49ers quarterback Steve Young. His new memoir is QB: My Life Behind the Spiral, which details his struggles with anxiety, his relationship with Joe Montana. It must have been just incredible to be able to put questions to rest about your legitimacy to take the quarterback job after Joe Montana when you won the Super Bowl as the starting quarterback.
And there's no question. And I think it was an odyssey. It was a journey. I don't know how to describe it any other way in dealing with expectations. And no matter, you know, we deal with them all the time, no matter what. But I had these outsized expectations. Sometimes I would have to tell people, teammates, that, you know, Joe did throw an interception. You know, he actually lost a game. Like I sometimes felt like I had to come out with the data, like to actually prove that something bad happened. I felt that way a lot. And so the expectations were like, felt like a mountain. And there was no way that I could, and I tried. I was so invested in the effort to try to deal with it and to overcome it and to show that I could stand in those shoes. And so it was, that's how it felt until about 1991, when I had a really seminal conversation with Steve Covey. I didn't mean to have it. It was on the plane. I just happened to sit down next to him. He's the one that wrote all the Seven Habits books. And I unloaded all this on him. Oh my gosh, this is so hard. This is so difficult. I'm in the middle of a season. No one, I'm overinvested. Everyone on football on the team is underinvested. I'm the one that's taking all the blame. I told him about the headline in the Chronicle. Football's too many people. This is too much to take. No one can deal with this. I've had it, you know. I don't know why. You know, you ever sat next to someone on the plane and you just do that? Like, it all comes out. Yeah. He listened quietly and said, then he said, when I was done, he said, Steve, let me ask you a couple questions because I truly understand what you're saying. There are too many people in football. He had this theory that 7 is the magic number for interaction between human beings. And once it add an 8th person, the it would devolve the organization and the work together, unity. And so he said 11's way too many. Basketball works great. Football doesn't work. So I understand what you're saying. But truly, let me ask you a couple questions. The 49ers, they're one of the best. I'm not a great fan of football, but they seem like one of the better organizations in football. And he said, yeah, they are. And I says, your coach, he's one of the great oh, my gosh, yes. And Joe Montana's on the team, right? And I said, yes, he is. That's the problem. And he goes, well, no, if you asked him, if you were able to ask him a question, you know, kind of as a tutor, could you get the mentorship from him? And I said, well, yeah, if I wanted to, he'd answer the question. He goes, Steve, I travel the world. I look everywhere in corporations, anywhere for platforms where people can be successful, platforms that allow people to see how good they can get. I got to be honest with you. As I travel the world and hear your story, the San Francisco 49ers and where you are right now might be one of the great platforms that I've ever seen for anybody to ever have to see how good you can get. My world turned upside down at that moment. So I looked at the whole struggle differently from then on.
Do you think then that you would have had a Hall of Fame career had you not been forced to be backup for Joe Montana?
I think that you build those expectations. You build an expectation in your mind. I think I had excellence in my head. I wanted to be great. I wanted to be Roger Staubach as I grew up. That was in my – so I knew I had excellence in my head. But I think looking back, I say the worst thing that ever happened to me is I had to do backup Joe Montana, but the best thing that ever happened to me because I watched him and I had to say, wow, how do I get there? And by witnessing it, I think it – to your point, Nina, I think it helped me the expectation so that whatever I did accomplish, if it wasn't to the excellence – I knew it wasn't enough. Like I didn't settle. It kept me moving. So by the way, you mentioned to the original question about the Super Bowl, it was a huge relief to know that the Bay Area, if you were going to be any good in the Bay Area, you better win a Super Bowl. I think when I got done with that conversation on the plane, I suddenly realized how lucky I was and that it really wasn't about the comparison and it really didn't have to be a weight. It could really be an inspiration. Go see how good you can get. He actually asked me, Steve, do you want to find out how good you are? I mean, it's at risk. You might not be very good. And he said, and I said, absolutely, I want to go find out. Well, then you've got a tremendous opportunity to go find out. And so from then on, I felt pressure. I felt, you know, all the things that you'd feel in trying to achieve things. But I didn't feel that the idea that I had to replace Joe Montana, I finally felt that I'd put that aside in my mind.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum. Our guest was former 49ers quarterback, Super Bowl champion, NFL MVP, and Hall of Famer, Steve Young. I spoke with him in October. Young's memoir is titled QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.